And I, of course, am reading it to find one of the things that I'm most interested in, which is pushing knowledge towards the places where it fails.
This is Chapter, Verse, and Season, a lectionary podcast from Yale Bible Study. Join us each week as two Yale Divinity School professors look at an upcoming text from the Revised Common Lectionary. Now is that strange time that we're writing and thinking about Easter sermons while also walking through the solemn time of Holy Week. To help us pivot to Easter, we welcome two new guests to the podcast, Lynn Tonstad, Associate Professor of Theology, Religion, and Sexuality, and Gijian Lin, Associate Professor of New Testament. They're discussing John chapter 20, verses 1 through 18, which is appointed for Easter Sunday, the resurrection of the Lord, in years A, B, and C. The text is read for you by alumnus Julian Sieber.
John chapter 20, verses 1 through 18. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Then Peter and the other disciple set out and went toward the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent down to look in and saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there and the cloth that had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture, that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples returned to their homes. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white, sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabuni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her.
So I looked this up because I was very curious. And in the Gospel of John, Jesus calls four people by name. He calls Simon Peter, Lazarus in the famous "Lazarus, come forth," and Philip, and Mary. And he also uses "woman" a whole lot to describe or to call his mother and the Samaritan woman and the woman in the pericope adulteri, and then here. But he switches between "woman" and "Mary" here. And I thought that was really an interesting change in this particular strange passage.
Yeah, it's like a turning point in the passage, right?
Yeah.
Because up until that point, with the exception of the "he saw and believed, they still did not understand" moment, the whole thing is in a way about a failure of recognition, mm-hmm. a failure of knowing, and an uncertainty about what's happening. And then the moment when Jesus turns from that woman to Mary, and then she turns in a different way. There's something really magical about that moment of turning and dawning recognition that's happening at each of those points.
Yeah, because she thinks he's the gardener. And there's no indication that he knows. I mean, I know I'm reading this against probable interpretation, but there's no indication that he knows who she is, right?
Maybe, does he realize it? Does he realize it at the moment that he hears her voice or something like that?
I mean, it could be a mutual recognition rather than having Jesus have all the knowledge. It would be an interesting, like, oh, it's you, right? Because he says, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for? What if we took those as earnest questions?
Right, instead of knowing already where this is going to go.
Right.
Well, I can't help but thinking, too, about, you know, the typical representations of Mary Magdalene in art history, where she's always, you know, got the long, blonde, curly, unbound hair with the red dress to indicate that, you know, she's being placed in a certain kind of social location by a particular history of interpretation.
Right.
So then I sort of imagine him standing behind her, looking at her. And yeah, maybe he doesn't know who it is. And maybe he's kind of discovering where he is and what he's doing in a new way, too, in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, we can't deny. I mean, okay, we can deny, but there's always the interpretation of an erotic, love, romantic relationship here, in which when he says Mary, right, it's a loaded moment. Because there's something about, and I think of all the pop cultural references of Say My Name, right?
Right, right, right.
I don't know. So that's one of the things that I first leap to when he says Mary, and she turns to him. But she doesn't call him anything but by title instead of name. So she doesn't name him. In fact, I don't know how many instances there are of people saying Jesus, right?
But the detail that she says it in Aramaic, the fact that that detail is included, you know, much like the linen strips, it's one of those moments where, you know, there's a kind of situatedness that peers through, even if we read John, as I typically do, as, you know, it was put in the Bible as a temptation to theologians, right? Because theologians just love to do all kinds of things with this book. But even here, you have these very situated details, the strips of linen lying there, the cloth, the lying in its place separate from the linen. Sorry, I'm using NKJV just because it's so pretty. And then you have the turning around, and then in Aramaic, there's something it's so specific, right? Mm-hmm. It's so particular, even though it comes from this moment of real destabilization and unknowing. It's still dark. We don't know where the Lord has been put. Everybody's running around. Kind of, I mean, if it's really dawn, you kind of imagine quite chaotically, right?
Yeah.
A little bit across purposes, maybe. And then that moment of dawning and the situatedness, the specificity. But of course, also, tell me where you've put him and I'll get him.
Yeah. Right?
That's so interesting. What is she going to do when she finds him?
Take him away.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Where is she going to take him?
Yeah.
And there is a, I think, a contrast. I mean, this is an easy dichotomy, but of like you're saying, the very situatedness of materiality, right, of the linen cloths. But then he also at the same time insists, don't touch me, right? So like, don't, yes and no, right, of like specificity and also a kind of, I don't know, untouchability where you, I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. What happens if you actually touch his body at this point?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's similar to the Doubting Thomas passage, right? Because it's always a question of does he actually touch him, or is the finger kind of hovering at the edge of his body? And what is the materiality of this body as it's moving through the world right now?
And that's interesting if you read this in contrast to the passage in which Lazarus is raised, which is the other resurrection that foreshadows this, in which there's a lot of materiality there too, because there's reference to the smell of a corpse and having been buried in grave clothes for 4 days. And then he comes out, right? And here we have, again, grave clothes that have been unwrapped, and you wonder, right, what is this person, right? And another resurrected being here. And I wonder too, if there's a, I don't know, can we talk about purity and impurity? Dead bodies, bodies who have come, that have come back to life, and that kind of, I don't know, I just wander into the material ritual understanding of what's happening here too.
Right, right. Well, there's also the kinds of changes too. Now I'm trying to really imagine the specificity of how they're standing in relation to each other, because she bends over and looks into the tomb, and then she turns around and sees Jesus, and then she turns towards him after the Mary moment. So how is she standing in between the kind of turning from the tomb towards Jesus, seeing him there,
yeah,
and then turning again when she recognizes him as teacher, or however it is that she's recognizing him.
Yeah, she turns twice.
Yeah, it's one of those ritual moments that just seems to indicate a kind of multi-level destabilization that's been happening here. Corpses that have come back to life, or what exactly, you know, this is one of those interesting questions with resurrection too. Yeah. Should it be thought of as coming back to life, right? Is it a reanimated corpse? Hopefully no, that would be something that maybe would be more terrifying than hopeful in most cases.
Or if we could also read it literally in that she does not recognize him because he just does not look the same.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I've always wondered why she thinks he's the gardener, right? Like, is there some implement that he's carrying? Or is it that he's in that location at that time, which would be like a gardener kind of thing to do?
Or yeah, in the early morning, the groundskeeper is there.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting, if you look at the beginning of the passage, she's there. She ran. And then Simon Peter and another unnamed disciple come running. So there's a lot of running about, the small detail that the other disciple outran Peter. And then they leave.
Yeah. And she stays.
Yes. So there's a lot of rushing. And then she stays and she weeps. And then he appears.
It's one of those moments at the end of the passage where, you know, historically we've done so much to kind of rediscover that, you know, Mary Magdalene as the earliest witness in certain ways, or as one of the earliest witnesses, you know, teaching the disciples who didn't have enough faith to stay, who didn't have enough courage. And we're often hoping that those rereadings, which are very much in the text, are going to destabilize some of the histories of masculine or patriarchal authority in relation to witnessing. And I think it would be nice if they had that effect. I think I'm always a little bit skeptical whether they do, because these stories can work in such contradictory ways in terms of what authorization we find in the story. And I, of course, am reading it to find one of the things that I'm most interested in, which is pushing knowledge towards failure, or sort of pushing it towards the places where it fails and where there's the kind of darkness that has come through a staying with loss.
Thanks for listening. Please check out yalebiblestudy.org for events, study guides, videos, and plenty of other resources, including a transcript for this episode. Chapter, Verse, and Season is a production of the Center for Continuing Education at Yale Divinity School. It's produced by creator and managing editor Joel Baden, production manager Kelly Morrissey, associate producer Aiden Stoddart, and I'm your host and executive producer Helena Martin. And our theme music is by Calvin Linderman. We'll be back with another conversation from Chapter, Verse, and Season.